Good morning. Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning when we're going to be talking about some healthcare issues. I also wanted to remind you before we get started that University College and Lemoyne College are co-sponsoring a series of two intelligent conversations, one at the end of April, April 25th, and the other the first week in May, May 2nd, at Lemoyne College called The Future of Medicine. The first one on April 25th, which is at 7 o'clock at Gruen Auditorium, and you can call UC for more information, is talking about personalized medicine. That is, some of you have heard about genetic testing, things like that, and how that is going to feed into the whole healthcare issue. So I have some flyers. It's on our website, and I highly recommend that to you. Those, which in this case we have two professors from upstate, one in biochemistry and the other in ethics, and they have a little bit of a back and forth. So it's a give and take, and of course, as always, there's a chance for Q&A. So I highly recommend that. Kind of a different take on Wednesday, June 6th, is the Onondaga Citizens League annual meeting. Richard Ravitch, who is a former lieutenant governor, who's also advising the city of Syracuse and some other cities on financial issues, is going to be the guest speaker. So that's June 6th. Also look on the Onondaga Citizens League website for that. Related to that, talking of Richard Ravitch and the city of Syracuse, Mayor Minor, the city of Syracuse, will be our guest speaker next week. I think there's going to probably be a lot of talk about the budget and the fiscal conditions, so you might want to bone up on that and come prepared with some questions. So, whew, lots going on, and that's not the end. But for now, it's my pleasure to welcome TMR member Lynn Shepherd-Scott, who is Senior Associate for Community Programming and Development at Upstate Medical University, to introduce Dr. McCabe. Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Dr. John McCabe is originally from Westchester County, received his undergraduate degree at University of Rochester, and then came to Upstate Medical University to receive his MD degree. He later completed his residency at Wright State University in Ohio in emergency medicine, then joined their faculty for about 5 years. Dr. McCabe returned to Upstate in 1987 and in 91 became the founding chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine. And that was the new academic Department of Emergency Medicine. In addition to serving as the chair, Dr. McCabe has previously served as the Vice President and Vice Dean for Clinical Affairs at Upstate Medical University. In that role, he was responsible for the oversight of clinical system, which included both University Hospital, the ambulatory practice sites, and as well as working on forming relationships with the other hospitals. In addition to his work locally, Dr. McCabe has been very active with the American Colleges of Emergency Physicians and the American Board of Emergency Medicine, holding all offices in each organization, including president of the board. Dr. McCabe has represented the specialty of emergency medicine at the American Board of Medical Specialties, or ABMS, and is currently the chair of their board. Dr. McCabe is currently Chief Executive Officer of University Hospital and Senior Vice President of Hospital Affairs for Upstate Medical University. And we want to welcome Dr. John B. McCabe.
Thanks, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be here. I've not been to this group for a long time, but it's nice to see some familiar faces and to reacquaint myself with some people that I haven't seen for a long time. I'm here as the CEO of University Hospital today, but I'm going to demonstrate my emergency medicine skills because I had a PowerPoint presentation and we're a little lacking in the technology. So as we used to say, that's why they call it emergency medicine, because you can do things and change on the fly at any moment. So I'm going to use my computer to kind of look at some notes, and only I get to see the pretty pictures, unfortunately, this morning. What I wanted to talk about is things that are changing in the healthcare landscape in Central New York. And specifically, I'll talk a little bit about healthcare and healthcare reform overall and some of the external forces that we see in the United States, that when you drive down into central New York, are causing hospitals, doctors, other healthcare pieces of the industry to act differently. So we'll talk about the forces, we'll talk about some of the things that I think we see changing here in central New York, and then I'll talk specifically about Upstate Medical University and University Hospital and the ways that we are responding and trying to build our own system to accommodate the changes that we see in the world around us. Many people have seen the slides that show the healthcare cost in the United States over the last 50 years, the comparison between us and other countries. And by any stretch, any slide that I put up would show you that our healthcare costs continue to rise. They're different than other countries. We're more expensive. And at the end of the day, we may not get the quality of care and the results and the outcomes that we would like for the dollars that we spend. And that really is the driving force behind all of the healthcare discussion of the last 30, 40 years, specifically the discussion around Obamacare and the recent changes. And at its core, healthcare reform is trying to reduce cost and increase accountability, improve quality, link payment to performance, and really try to transform the healthcare system from what I call a piece goods industry to a population management industry. So it's piece goods. If a doctor does one thing, they get paid once. If they do two things, they get paid twice, and on and on. And we really need to think about managing the health of the population as a whole. And those are really some of the objectives. Now, with healthcare reform, there are lots of things that are being tossed around that are things that may or may not happen. Individual mandate, accountable care organizations, insurance exchanges. And those are really the tactics that are being proposed to get the system, again, to more cost-efficient, more accountability, better quality outcomes, and better population management. If you look both locally and around the country, how does that actually play out? What are the things that hospitals and physicians and practices are beginning to do to try to get themselves, get their arms better around those principles? Well, first, and the one that you see very frequently and in the paper and in the news here and elsewhere, is hospital consolidations, mergers, and affiliations. So they're very prevalent here in central New York, Upstate and Community General Hospital. You've seen Auburn trying to link up with a hospital in Rochester, Faxton, St. Luke's, St. Elizabeth, and Rome to our east. And I could go on because almost every corner of the state has a consolidation. And the consolidations are, again, about trying to reduce costs, to build a bigger system, and to be able to take care of an array of patient needs across spectrum of disease, across lifespan from beginning to end, and really trying to manage populations of patients and their care. So number one thing that clearly is happening as a result of this core principles of push for healthcare reform is hospital consolidation. The second is that private practice physicians are beginning to act differently than they used to. And so in the past, physicians went to the hospital. They covered their patients when they were there. They were on call for the emergency department. And more as physicians get squeezed, they are trying harder and harder to kind of rein in their practice so that they can, in many ways, preserve the ways that they've become accustomed to living. So some physicians are becoming more office-based and less out in the community and the hospitals. In many practices, physicians aren't replacing themselves, so groups are getting smaller, which puts a squeeze on access. And physicians are looking for ways to supplement their income and their practice income. So you see the expansion of surgical centers, diagnostic facilities, ways that hospitals used to make money that now physicians in the community can own and manage. They're expecting to be paid for call when they come to the hospital. They're expecting to be paid to help manage an inpatient unit. So if there's a unit in a hospital that's all orthopedic patients, the orthopedists desire to be paid by the hospital to help improve the quality and the outcomes in that particular unit. So all those things are really changing the fundamental relationship of hospitals to doctors and vice versa. The third thing that's happening is we see lots of movement around in places that it hasn't been before. So if you opened the Post Standard on Monday, you saw a full-page ad from the University of Rochester about urology. Well, why would they be advertising in Syracuse? So they're trying to move patients in that direction. If you look to the east, to Bassett Healthcare in Cooperstown, they've recently opened an entity in Oneida County, so they're moving this way. You've seen physician practices moving around, so most prominently in this community, Syracuse Orthopedic Specialties, having been moved from Community General site over to St. Joseph's. So hospitals are trying to attract the most lucrative of the specialists. Physicians are trying to coalesce in a way that helps them. And the centers that used to be distant, where there was kind of an imaginary line, say down Auburn, between us and Rochester, have just disappeared. So those things are all forces out in the world that are changing kind of fundamental relationships of hospital to hospital in this region, hospital to hospital across the state, and physician to hospital relationships in the region. And they're all being driven again by potential for reimbursement to go down as we try to save costs, and by the coalescence of things to try to improve quality and accountability, and the desire to have bigger systems of care to be able to manage populations of patients and manage health on a continuum from birth through preventive medicine through end-of-life care. So those are the forces on the outside that are driving some of the things that we at Upstate and elsewhere in the region are happening. So let me switch then from that to talk for a moment about Upstate Medical University. So we are a hospital, but fundamentally we're a university. So we have four colleges. We have a large research enterprise and a clinical enterprise. And I often say at Upstate we're in the knowledge business. So we create knowledge, that's research. We pass on knowledge, that's our education programs for nursing students and health professionals and physicians. And then we use knowledge every day. That's our clinical environment. So we're in the knowledge business, and we just happen to have a hospital as one of the places where all three of those kind of knowledge-related activities go on. Dr. Smith, were he here, would talk about us being the finest regional medical center in the nation. That's the goal. So that's our simple goal. And we really have that regional responsibility. If you map out any of the services we provide, whether it's trauma services or poison control center or pediatric intensive care services, we really have a geography that goes from the Canadian border to the Pennsylvania border and at least partway to Rochester and Albany, although the ads are kind of changing that dynamic a little bit. So clearly we have a regional responsibility for healthcare and for workforce and for research. And we take that very seriously. We're now a $1.3 billion enterprise, largest employer in Central New York. And the vast, vast majority of the funds that fuel that enterprise at $1.3 billion are clinically generated. So University Hospital, Community General Hospital, our physicians, as I say, earn money the old-fashioned way. They provide service, and someone pays them for it. Interestingly, the amount of dollars that come to our institution from the state of New York is a very small slice of the pie. And so for University Hospital, it's a couple percent of the total dollars that I get every year to run the institution come from state resources. Vast majority are earned the same way as every other hospital and healthcare institution in the region. So what are the things that Upstate's doing to try to respond to those external forces around accountability, cost reduction, and systemness, if you will? Well, I have five or six things that we're doing. So first is that we continue, because we have this tertiary care and regional responsibility, to put in place service and technology that's unique to the region, things that other people don't have. And I often say, at University Hospital, we take care of the patients that others can't or won't. Can't, maybe because we have technology or services or physician specialties that others don't have. And sometimes won't is because there isn't a service out there, or maybe it's a patient population that others aren't so excited about taking care of, the underserved, the underprivileged, and the like. So in order to do that, technology is one. And I have some examples of things in the last year that we've put in place that are unique, things like a PET CT scanner. That's a diagnostic technology related to cancer diagnosis. A gamma knife, a new way to treat patients with cancer. All of us have Da Vinci robots, and we have the latest robot widget in our hospital. And fancy machines to do cardiac catheterization and ablation procedures. So just a couple examples of technology and services that we put in place. The second is we continue to look and be sure that we have a full spectrum of practitioners. Now, sometimes that's simple stuff like having another general surgeon or a trauma surgeon or a diabetologist But for us, it's also being sure that we're filling the unique niches that are in the Central New York region. So things like a pediatric surgery group, a pediatric radiologist, a neurosurgeon who can go and get a clot out of your brain like nobody else can, a neurocritical care doctor, somebody who spends all their time in an ICU devoted just to the patients with brain injury and disease. So some of those, a transplant surgeon, some of those are things that are unique to us. And so we continue to try to attract those unique practitioners in the tertiary care center and to fill that out. The third is, while we're making all the changes in healthcare reform and becoming more of a system, we haven't forgotten about the safety net services that we provide. So I could give you a list of the things that we do that nobody else does. A burn unit, a kidney transplant, a prisoner unit for prisoners in New York State, a trauma service, a bone marrow transplant, hyperbaric inpatient care, pediatric ICU. Those are important services that we continue to offer that we put in the safety net. They have to be here in a region like this, and we'll always, no matter how we're doing systemness around the edges, provide those services. If you've driven by the hospital recently, you know that we're building and we're growing. So there's a big hole in front of my hospital, which is the new cancer center. And that's designed to really, again, pull together in a multidisciplinary way lots of different services. And there'll be some unique technology in that building. There's going to be new radiation therapy equipment that you won't find for probably another 500-mile radius. There is a very unique operating room that will be there, which will allow a surgeon to move a patient without taking them off the table from inside an MRI machine onto an operating room table, where they can do a little more surgery, move them back, and make sure they've gotten all of a brain tumor out, then move them back to the operating room. So unique technology that's not going to be duplicated elsewhere in the region. So we're building. We're trying to control costs just like everybody else. And so within the institution, we have our own metrics. I have my own kind of marching orders from Dr. Smith and from the state of New York to be sure that we are improving quality, reducing cost, getting rid of the unnecessary duplications. And if you saw the news yesterday, you saw a really interesting story about a number of national organizations who've said to the physicians in the United States, stop testing so much. I think you may have seen that in the news. And so those are the kinds of initiatives that all institutions are going to have to do. Is this next EKG or stress test or CT scan really necessary? And there's a hard line there of saying, let's make sure we only do the necessary things, but over here, every time we do something else, it may be good for our bottom line. So trying to balance those out and provide quality care, accountability, and cost reduction at the same time. We're focused every day on quality in my institution, just like all of the hospitals in Central New York. We're proud that for the first time ever this year, U.S. News and World Report recognized us as the best regional hospital and recognized us specifically for some of our services, urology, ENT, cancer. We continue to be reported on in the public and on websites of the federal government and others, just like every other hospital. So we pay attention to our cardiac surgery outcomes, to our catheter infections, to unavoidable events, to never events. And we take that very seriously on a everyday basis, because no matter how big I build the system or how much systemness I have, if I don't have quality care and I'm not focused on the patient first and foremost, then I really haven't built anything that's useful. And then lastly, we are more and more beginning to think about being not just university hospital, but being university health system. So how do we transition and move ourselves from what was 15 years ago an academic tertiary care hospital, kind of with an attitude which was, we're here, they'll come, to now a health system that says we can offer quality care, patient-oriented, family-friendly, regardless of the service you need, from birth through early life, through preventive care, through simple kind of care, to the most complex technology, to subacute care, to subacute rehabilitation, to a nursing home, and maybe even back to assisted living. So the concept of a system is to be able to take care of that full spectrum of patients across the entire spectrum of their medical lifetime, and to be sure that patients, as I often say, are every patient is in the right bed at the right time. So So you maybe don't need a nursing home. You need subacute care. You maybe don't need subacute care. You need to go home to assisted living. You maybe need to be in a very intensive ICU, or maybe you need to be in a little less intensive, less costly ICU. So those are kind of the reasons for building a system of care. Gives us the full range of services. We can control costs across that spectrum better. We can be prepared for the changes that will occur in reimbursement down the road. We can also then have the platform to educate future providers, because it makes no sense for us as a medical school to be teaching doctors to only work in a high-end tertiary care center when we know that most of them are going to go out into the community and be in private practice and maybe never set foot in a hospital again, or set foot in a hospital that's much more like a Community General or St. Joe's or Krause than in a university hospital environment. So we have to be sure we have the right platform for the education of the future healthcare providers. So to that end, then, let me talk about two things that have been kind of on our plate as we've tried to build from just a university hospital to a broader system. One was the acquisition of Community General Hospital, which occurred back in July 7th of last year after 15 or 18 months worth of hard work. That was a change for us in terms of acquisition, because it made our system much bigger, gave us more capacity, hooked us to a different set of providers in the community. And again, it's allowed us, if you will, to think about spreading the patients across a broader base with a different cost structure, with a different set of services. And it also added some services that we didn't have before. Obstetrics, for instance. We never had an obstetrical unit at University Hospital. So it was an asset acquisition. I think so far it's been pretty successful. It has a ways to go, and it really is kind of a five-year plan. We recently asked the employees at Community General what they thought of the acquisition. And on a number of parameters, we're pretty pleased. Probably about 75 to 80% were very satisfied or satisfied with the acquisition process. They are satisfied with their current environment. And really interestingly, one of the things that they see most as opportunities for themselves is in education and personal advancement. So being part of a bigger system allows that employee base, about 900 employees who we took on, to be part of a bigger system and to see future opportunities in their own area for personal growth. So we're very satisfied with that. We have successfully kind of integrated the two hospitals into one. And so we talk about one hospital, one medical staff, one workforce. And we're beginning to move some services around so that, again, the services are in the right place, and we use the capacity as best as we possibly can. We've opened some new services at Community General that didn't exist before that have really been helpful for us as a system. We opened an epilepsy monitoring unit over there in October. We've added coverage with neurologists, neurosurgeons, pulmonary physicians that weren't there before. You've probably recently seen the news that we opened a after-hours urgent care location for pediatric patients, unique to the region. Being very well received. We're moving our bariatric surgery program there since it's a more appropriate location. And we have plans down the road to coalesce our pain center, some women's health services, and we have two large services that now exist in both places that we will consolidate, psychiatry and physical medicine rehabilitation. So we're just not certain yet which ones are going which direction. But there'll be a consolidation with one of those services downtown and one of those services at Community General. We've invested capital. So this year's capital plan for Community is about $7.5 million. On average, for the last 10 years, Community had invested probably just shy of a couple million dollars. So we're improving the facility. And if you've been there, you've probably seen some evidence of that as you walk into the lobby or as you see the urgent care center for kids. It is still a work in progress and probably will be for a few more years. But we think we have expanded our system, allowed us to do some things we couldn't do before in the big context that I described earlier, saved an asset in the community that we thought was important, left acute care on the west and south side for a patient population that wants to be there. So we think so far it's successful, certainly for our health system development, but also for the community at large. The other obvious big project that's been out and about in the news with us as we get to more system is the Van Dine discussion. And that's kind of the other end of our health system spectrum, if you will. Now, why would we be interested in Van Dine? Well, we'd be interested in Van Dine because we, again, have to move patients through the acute care to the subacute care to nursing home if needed and beyond. In this community, there is really a nursing home crisis in many ways. If you look on any given day, there is a large number of patients that are sitting in hospital beds that really ought to be in nursing home beds. At University Hospital, it's probably somewhere in the range of 15 to 20-ish patients a day that really could be somewhere else if there was somewhere else for them to go. Sometimes it's just a question of no bed available. Sometimes it's a question of very difficult or complex patients where they need a specialized unit. So, for instance, if you are a patient permanently on a ventilator, if you're a patient with a traumatic head injury, if you're a patient with a large wound that's not healing that needs daily attention, it's unlikely that we will be able to easily find a place in a nursing home community to send you. So you end up staying in the hospital. Creates inefficiencies, uses capacity inappropriately. So we believe that by adding a nursing home to our health system, we will be able to take a place like Van Dine, work on improving the quality there, again, provide a platform for geriatric education for our students and for our future doctors, and begin to kind of reshape and build the kinds of services and the beds that would be good for the community, good for our patient population as well. So we entered into a discussion about a year ago with the county about the potential transfer. We see the relationship again as one around quality improvement, fiscal relief for the county, a platform for geriatrics and a center of excellence for geriatric care, a reconfiguration of what is now a 528-bed nursing home into an entity that has a different kind of mix of beds that's more appropriate to the needs that we think are there, and a place that we could continue to carry on the mission of both the county and university hospital of serving a vulnerable population that oftentimes gets left in the dust. And so we want to be sure that is preserved. We're pretty far down the road of a discussion, and we're not very far down the road of a discussion. So, as always, in the background, we've done lots of due diligence. We understand the institution pretty well. We understand the financing and the difficulty of a nursing home. And yet there are some things that have to still occur. We need to be absolutely certain that we could run it and not be bleeding cash every week or every year. So that's important for us to get there. And there are some technical issues with reimbursement that need to get worked out. There's a whole discussion about how one would transfer the property. There's the labor issue of their county employees now. What would they become? There's the need for bonding to actually change the facility and use the site because it's a large acreage site to our advantage and the patient's advantage over time. And so there's lots of things that are still sitting out there. If we wish to move forward, we're trying to work each one of those issues separately, both with us and the county to reach agreement, with the county and the state for their agreement, with the federal government, since there's reimbursement issues from the federal government. And then lastly, since we are a SUNY institution, obviously we need SUNY support and approval to move forward. And they appropriately are being very cautious with us and saying, let's be sure this is appropriate. Let's be sure before you add one more thing to your system. And as anybody who's watching healthcare news in the state knows, the Medicare reform team, the problems of Berger in commission down in Brooklyn, problems with some of the hospitals there, Roswell Park kind of being in uncertain status. So SUNY and the state are kind of appropriately looking and saying, well, wait a minute, let's be sure we really want to do this and be sure we really have a viable plan before we say, go ahead, upstate and the county, march ahead. So in many ways, it's kind of back in Albany and in SUNY to get it massaged to a comfort level that everyone from the county executive to our local leadership to the SUNY Board of Trustees to the governor's office are comfortable and happy with. So I hope we'll get there, but I have no guarantees that we'll get there. I think at the end of the day it would be useful for our system, but it's one that still needs a fair amount of work in massaging. Lastly, we at Upstate have some unique challenges as we try to move healthcare reform. You know, we, like other state institutions, are saddled with a pension cost that's enormous. And the slide, which I can't show you, is probably good because when I look at it, I cry every time I see it. The pension costs, we have a labor cost that's higher than other hospitals in the region. So we have some crosses to bear that are unique to upstate in this healthcare. Lastly, there are some things I haven't talked about. I haven't talked about kind of what everybody, I think, sees as the obvious increasing competition within this community. So healthcare competition is kind of at an unprecedented level. All you have to do is drive 690 and you realize that 4 out of 5 billboards are somebody advertising a medical service in this community. I haven't talked about what's the future configuration of health systems in Syracuse. And, you know, you can pick future as a year from now, 5 years, 10, 20. Is there one health system? Are there 2 health systems? Are there 3 health systems? And it's kind of, one of those topics that's down here that we all think about but nobody really talks about yet. We probably should. We haven't talked about hospitals on the brink. So there are hospitals like Carthage Hospital, if you've watched the Watertown newspaper, that really are in significant trouble and probably need some help now in order to survive. There's hospitals on the way to being on the brink, and I could list a number of them that if things don't change or they're not successful in their affiliations, will be in trouble. We haven't talked much about physician employment. And this is something all the hospitals are dealing with. If you were to plot out a curve of physicians in private practice or employment over the last 20 years, private practice is doing this and physician employment is doing this. And we've pretty much almost crossed the line where pretty soon more doctors will be employed than they will be in private practice for themselves. And I haven't talked about the impact of health reform on graduate medical education. That is, how are we going to ensure that 5 and 10 and 20 years from now, we have not only sufficient doctors, but we have the right doctors to take care of patients in the future healthcare system. So with that, I'll stop. I think I'm pretty close to my half hour. Hopefully I've given you a little bit of sense of kind of the broad overview of healthcare reform, some of the things that are driving change, a little bit about Syracuse market, and some discussion about upstate specifically. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Not unexpectedly, we have a lot of questions.
40 years ago, we were having private discussions in town about how to get upstate away from New York State's legislature control. What would you do differently today if you were not controlled by the state legislature? The second question, very quickly, is, we spend more money than any other nation in the world per person for medical care, and yet we are not very high in the quality. What is the reason for that, and what can we do to change it?
I mean, the second question, I think you have to look and say healthcare outcome is really complex. It's not just about how much money you spend, but it's about our education system. It's about our transportation system. It's about job opportunities. And so all those things link in. And I think you can't just look at the healthcare outcome and say, oh, we have a bad healthcare system. Maybe we have a bad social support system, too. And maybe we have a bad education system. And maybe we have too much violence. And so it's complex. To the first question, I can say we regularly talk about, or maybe we regularly fantasize about, what would it be like if we had less state rules? And I often say, you know, I get 2% of my money and 100% of my rules from the state of New York. So, and it's true. There are things like our labor contracts are not negotiated by us. They're negotiated in Albany for the state as a whole. The procurement processes we use are difficult. So we often cite the example, it's easier to get a CT scan for a horse at Cornell Vet School than it is for me to get a new CT scan for a university hospital. So there are lots of things that we would or could do differently. And there is an active discussion about what the right relationship of the hospitals to both SUNY and the state of New York is. And I assume that's going to be a continuing conversation.
Doctor, I would like to ask you, what percentage of the cost of medicine do you attribute to malpractice insurance? And also, I'll read a little clipping that I took from the paper giving the cost of OBGYN insurance on Long Island. It's $186,772 a year, and upstate it is $52,000 and some odd dollars. The point, and then also, these studies that these doctors decided are not necessary. How many of those, a failure to do those, is going to lead to more malpractice?
So many of the physicians.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I would guess if you ask 50 doctors this question, you'd get 49 of the same answers, and then there'd be me. So. Because I'm a little bit of an outlier, and maybe it comes from my emergency medicine background. Do I think doctors practice defensively? Certainly some. It's very hard to measure, though, how much people practice defensively.
I can tell you that I'm an orthopedic surgeon.
That's okay. I mean, people do practice defensively, but I don't think it's the primary driver. Secondly, I think, the easy answer is just put a cap on pain and suffering. You know, max them out at $250,000. That's it. So, and I actually think that's bad policy because I actually think there are times when mistakes are made and we ought to own up to them. And there are times that we as physicians cause damage and people should be compensated for it. Now, having said that, it would be nice if in the state of New York we had a couple of simple things like every other state in the country has pre-trial depositions and identification of expert witnesses. We don't do that in New York. So the expert witness shows up in court the day you're being tried. It's like the old Perry Mason aha moment. That doesn't happen elsewhere, and lots of things are dispensed with in other states. So there is malpractice reform that I think would be very helpful. There's a component of cost that's due to defensive medicine. There's no question about that. And the cost of insurance is high. There's no question about that. And it's gone up. On the other hand, there is real injury that needs to be compensated. The last is we hear a lot about physicians leaving the state or physicians stopping doing this or that because their malpractice costs are high. I'm not sure that's as well documented as people would like it to be. It's an easy thing to say. Dr. X left the state because the malpractice premiums were too high. Well, let's pretend Dr. X used to make $750,000 and his cost of insurance was $50,000 and now it's $100,000. We've eaten into Dr. X's practice, but we really haven't put him out of business. So it's real, but I think, for me, I think it's way overblown. And I say that from a malpractice insurance business, too. The four state university centers, the medical schools, we own our own malpractice company. So I sit on the board of the malpractice company, so I know the malpractice industry pretty well in New York State as well. So, and again, a lot of people would disagree with me, and I'm fine with that. So,
okay, we have a question over here now, Dr. Borsani.
Rick Santorum recently made the statement that we're not sure of his source, that a number of California universities did not teach American history. Well, I guess they Googled it, and they found there was only one. But it was a medical school. So my question is, the rap on medical schools always has been that the education is too narrow, it isn't broad enough, that there isn't that correct mix of the liberal arts. Now, we don't expect medical schools to produce Renaissance people. But my question is, what is the state of medical education, especially at Upstate, in terms of that issue, and what is the future?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, when I went to medical school, you were a biology major, you did 4 years of school, and you went to medical school. That was the path. I think in recent years, the path into medical school has changed a lot. Some of that is because kids have changed a lot. I mean, it's anybody who's had recent college graduate kids know that more and more often they graduate, they go off and do something for a little bit, get a little bit of maturity, and then decide. So we're seeing students a little bit later, a couple years, and we're seeing them with some more worldly experience than they used to have. And I think that's good because it makes people, you know, better human beings and better interactors with other human beings. So that's good. Having said that, for the most part in the U.S., we still teach in a fairly traditional scientific way. You know, we've all changed where our physician students get medical or get patient experience earlier. So used to be you saw your first patient in your third year. Now they see their first patient on their first day. I think that's very positive. But we still largely teach in large academic centers. And again, most physician graduates will be practicing in community and practices in smaller communities. So I think we still have a mismatch there that we just haven't corrected. So,
thank you.
In the same education vein, it was recently published in the paper about accreditation issues and so on with your school. How serious are those issues, and what impact do you see they might have on student recruitment?
So they're a little bit off to the side from where I spend my usual day, but being part of the leadership team, I obviously am a part of it. I guess we would say it's a serious issue because it shouldn't have happened, and we're concerned anytime there is an accreditation issue. You have to remember that the bulk of the citations were about technical things like departments that weren't getting their grades in on time. They weren't about an objective look or a concern about the quality of the medical student at the end of their 4 years of education here. So we're taking them seriously. There are, I can tell you, a significant change in the school going on now to address all of the citations. We're very comfortable that within a 15 to 24 month time frame, which is usual, we'll be reversed and be off probation. At the same time, we remain a fully accredited medical school. And so we can accept students and pass them through. And we've not seen any diminution in our student applicant pool. And for the most part, I don't expect it to impact the clinical side, other than the occasional person who says, well, you know, if they're on probation, they must have bad care, so I'm not going to university hospital. We've not seen that. And I think most people are can get past it. So serious issue that we're going to fix.
You spoke about quality and accountability. What are three metrics you would use to identify a hospital that you would go to and a physician, and where would you find this data?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's hard. On the physician side, I think one, and you know, I'll speak from my American Board of Medical Specialties role, which is the organization that oversees board certification for all of the specialties. So one is board certification. It's a gold standard. Regardless of whether you're an orthopedist or emergency physician, it means you've met a standard that's been set nationwide, and it's about training and it's about quality. And now it's about doctors who are keeping up their practice, demonstrating that they are quality physicians. So for the doctor, it's probably board certification is one. Most people get their doctor by asking somebody else in their family or friend circle who they went to and who they liked. So I think personal referral is still, you know, for many people probably number one, because you need to trust your doctor and you need to feel good about your doctor. On a hospital side, I think it's very hard because I can't tell you how many metrics we're tracked on by people other than us, and then how many metrics we track ourselves on. So the easiest one to go to is the federal government, which is hospitalcompare.gov. And certainly there you can see a range of things. But I think we're still, in the hospital world, we're still pretty early in terms of knowing what to measure, knowing that it really is quality. And there's a difference between kind of process measures that we can look at and outcome measures that we can look at. So, you know, a process measure would be, you know, did somebody with a heart attack get an aspirin? That's a process. But did a person with a heart attack actually do better in our hospital system than had they had the exact same disease in another hospital? That's an outcome measure. And we're still pretty rudimentary in our understanding of how to really measure process outcome. So does that help? Board certification on the doc side, and there's a number of sites, but probably the easiest is Hospital Compare. And that's, of course, Medicare data only, but.
Dr. McCabe, earlier in your discussion, you mentioned how the hospital embraces the new technologies. Could you give us some insight into how the hospital handles the training these new
these new technologies bring.
Yeah. I mean, if, you know, there's a couple answers. Many times the new technology that we bring is kind of spurred on by the practitioners who are coming who have been in an environment where they trained or learned with the new technology. So that's one. And so sometimes we have somebody in place already, and the reason we're doing the technology is because of them. In the absence of that, anytime we bring on kind of new procedures or complex technology, we do go through a credentialing process. And even sometimes we'll send our practitioners away somewhere else to train, same process, same procedure elsewhere before we allow it. And then as part of a hospital accreditation, it used to be the Joint Commission. We use a different accrediting body now, but same idea. When we grant new privileges to somebody as a physician, we also have to have in place a plan for us to go back over time and to monitor and watch the performance in a new procedure. So you can't just show up at a hospital these days and say, I'm really good at this. I've never done it here before. You've never done it here before, but is it okay if I do it? You do it with some rules and some follow-up, and from a medical staff, organized medical staff point of view, a look. And that's important because the organization of the physicians, the medical staff, who credentials and monitors and provides that assurance, has an arm's-length relationship to me. So I can't control them, and that's a good thing, because if I could control them, I could say, well, I don't care. He's doing pretty well. Keep doing it because it's good for me. That would be a really bad circumstance. So by design, we're arm's-length.
Hi, Dr. McCabe. The health insurance mandate that everyone has to have health insurance, you know, it's a political issue, it was a legislative issue, and now I guess it's a judicial issue. From a hospital administration standpoint, how does that mandate or lack of mandate figure in? Is there a quantifiable effect on hospital care?
Yeah. So, you know, again, being an emergency physician, I personally believe that it's good if everybody had health insurance, because in the current environment, those of us who do are paying for those who don't. So from that point of view, I mean, politics aside, and whether the Supreme Court's going to rule that, you know, then we need to buy broccoli for everybody or whatever they discussed last week. So I think the mandate, from my perspective, is good. In New York State, because the Medicaid program is so lenient in terms of entry, the percentage of uninsured patients in New York State is relatively small. So nationwide, it's probably 16 or 18%. In my institution, it's probably 6 or 7%. So we're not going to see the huge increase of patients who were previously uninsured who are now insured as, say, a state like Texas. So we may not quite get the boom that other states do. The worry for a place like mine is that there's two pieces. As more and more people are insured, the government plans to drop what's called the DSH payment, which is the disproportionate share. And those are dollars that the feds provide to hospitals like ours for the care of uninsured and underinsured. And the goal, of course, would be that you ramp up the people who are now have insurance and you ramp down those payments. Well, if you ramp down those payments too quickly, or if you have a state like New York where you don't get that much of a ramp up, you could put large academic institutions in potential financial jeopardy. And so that's probably the biggest concern, is the disappearance of the DSH, or the disproportionate share hospital payments.
We hear time and time again that the end-of-life care expenses for Medicare is a large percentage. I'm wondering why such minimal resources are dedicated to palliative care, which could help transition people away from aggressive treatment of dubious benefit, I guess.
Well, I think there's a couple answers. One, again, if you go back to a piece goods industry, because I can do another thing, I do another thing. And that's a problem with the medical system as a whole. I think most of us recognize we have not paid enough attention to comfort care and caring for people as opposed to providing, you know, technology care at the end of life. I think all the hospitals in Syracuse are beginning to move in that direction. I know that University Hospital has one of the highest referrals to palliative care for patients at the end of life of all the hospitals in the state. We're also, and I didn't talk about it, but looking at how to put palliative care unit within our hospital health system structure. One of the hard parts is it's easy as a group to talk about palliative care and doing less for, you know, my relative at the end of their life. It's much harder when that person actually is sick and close to the end of their life and in a hospital. So it really has to back up, and they have to be solid discussions that occur earlier on, because they're very tough at acute times.
My question is prefaced on the assumption that you're responsible for the clinic system near upstate, correct? Okay. A few weeks ago here, we had a long discussion about Medicaid dollars and emergency room usage. How seriously is upstate invested in the specialist system, especially in areas like pediatric neurology and accessibility of service? My experience has been that a child repeatedly goes to the ER because the wait for a pediatric neurology appointment is 4 months.
Yeah. You touch on a couple of things. I'll take the specialists first. There are areas, and pediatric neurology is a good example, unfortunately, where, you know, there's probably a half a dozen pediatric neurologists that are trained every year in the country. And so there are some super specialties that are just very hard to find and to fill. And pediatric neurologists are much more likely to end up in a New York City or Boston or Philadelphia than they are in a Syracuse. And that's just the reality. So there are some serious workforce issues. And unfortunately, there's a few examples where upstate provides a slice of the service. Nobody else provides the service anywhere in the region. And it's just been really near impossible to expand that consistently. So you raise a good issue. The ER one is, again, a controversial one. My view is that if you look at healthcare spending as a whole, under 2 cents of every dollar spent for healthcare in the United States, under 2 cents, goes to care of patients in the emergency department. And my view is, for 2 cents of the dollar, what do you get? You get a system of care in the United States where anybody, insured, uninsured, any time of day, regardless of what's wrong with them or what they think is wrong with them, can get care. Now, having said that, are there patients who would be better served in another environment than the emergency department? Absolutely. Absolutely. But when you take the case of pediatric neurology, it doesn't exist here. If you're a Medicaid patient and you're trying to find a primary care physician who will see you at 5 o'clock in the evening because you can't skip work and you have to have somebody do your child care, you can't find that in this community readily. So you could move people out of the emergency department, but you have to have a place to move them to, and that's primary care, and it's a larger access issue in this community and many other communities. But my view is 2 cents of the dollar is a pretty darn good insurance policy for the entire country.
Good morning. In the layman's press, I've been reading a little bit about the issue of medical arrogance and quality control. And one of the ways of getting to the heart of the problem are checklists for various and sundry procedures. Where does the check, and they work when the checklists work when the hospital administration stands behind the implementer of the checklist, which is usually a nurse. So where does the checklist issue stand in central New York specifically?
Oh, I think, have the hospitals in Syracuse region embraced the concept of checklists? Absolutely. They probably are most prevalent in the operating room, but really in any procedural area. And I can tell you that in our hospital and every hospital in the region these days, before operation begins, there's a standard timeout, and it really is called a timeout. And it's a timeout where the anesthesiologist and the nurses will be in a room and the techs will be in a room and the residents and the physician all stop and make sure, via a checklist, that they're all on the same page as far as what they're going to do, the expectations of what might go right, the expectations of what might go wrong, being sure that the right patient's there. You know, you've seen the orthopedists for many years put their initial on your knee before you go to the OR, before you go to sleep. So I think the whole concept of checklists is more and more embraced. Is it in every aspect of medicine? Not yet, but it's there.
You've talked about some planning and coordination issues and needs, assessment of needs. What role do the Hospital Executive Council and the Health Systems Agency in Central New York play as far as some of those issues, you know, rooms, equipment?
Well, you have a number of things. Remember, New York State's a CON state, so the advancement of a new program or a large piece of equipment or the like goes through a state planning process, which is still pretty rigorous and probably is the biggest point of control. You do have in Central New York the Central New York HSA, the Health Systems Agency, and I think they play a role as far as a forum for discussion. I don't think they truly have an authority to say yes or no or to stop something. But, you know, in the case of the community general discussion, they provided a very useful forum for the interested parties to be in the same place and to air their concerns and for us to modify our planning some. The Hospital Executive Council is the kind of regular grouping of the three hospital CEOs, and I think that's been very useful for the kinds of things that we can agree to do together. You know, for instance, we work together to try to find better ways to take those difficult-to-place patients and get them into nursing homes. We look at our utilization data. So now, having said that, I think one of the hardest juggling acts, and I think Paul Cronenberg or Kathy Rosito would say the same, is how do you cooperate in an environment that is increasingly competitive, where the competition is being driven by outside sources that are beyond our control? So the University of Rochester, the federal government, state reform are all forcing us to have to be competitive. And at the same time, in a city like Syracuse, if we're not cooperative, it just leads to a medical arms race and mutual annihilation. And that makes no sense because who gets caught in the middle there? All of you as patients. And that makes no sense.
Thank you, Dr. McCabe. I want to remind everybody about the future of medicine. Syracuse.